Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
This is Mike Edison, host of Art Senses a Seizure, as you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, please visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to another week of The Main Course without Patrick Martins. Sitting in for Patrick today is my co-host, Philip Gilmore.
Good morning.
I'm, of course, Alexis McLaughlin. And in studio, we have Chef Warren Baird and Chef Katie O'Donnell. They are from Chapter One, a restaurant in West Village. And formerly of Esca, Chef Warren was the sous chef for a while, and Katie was the chef de cuisine for about 8 years.
Well, I didn't start out as chef de cuisine, but yes, by the time I left, I was the chef de cuisine. I was there for almost 8 years.
Great. And then now you're both with Chapter One and working on a heritage series, so we're going to talk about that today a little bit more.
Cool. What is the concept of the heritage series, first off?
Well, it started when we said, let's do some sort of a Sunday supper. And, you know, you look around, everybody's doing meatloaf and fried chicken. And, you know, it was something that we wanted to do to generate some business on Sunday nights. And then about the same time, I was also sort of trying to figure out the direction of the food. And, you know, I did Italian under Katie and did some Spanish and French. You know, we all started French back in the day. And so simultaneously, this idea surfaced to take the Sunday supper and start focusing on the origins of American food a little bit. Because as a chef, what I'm trying to do, you know, I can fake Italian, I can fake French, I can fake this, but, I've never really, you know, it would be sort of a, to be due to American food would be more authentic. So that's where it started, with Sunday suppers.
I really like the idea of the heritage series, and, you know, because Chapter One itself is described as contemporary American tavern. And then you're doing dinners once a month and picking a theme, like, with a historical context. And really, it seems like you guys are doing a lot of research and really fleshing out this kind of larger concept for
like
a dinner.
It's going back to school sometimes.
Yeah.
Man, so the things that I learned that I forgot about our own history, it's amazing.
Yeah.
The upcoming dinner is going to be April 12th. That's going to be Thomas Jefferson themed, which is interesting to think about as a food concept.
Yeah, well, his birthday is the following day. So I think actually Katie's idea was like, you know, he's done some stuff. Everything's surrounding a really good story. So, you know, we've done 19th century New Orleans, and we've done a 1620s pilgrim dinner that was around the time. It's time appropriate, too. So that was in November. And then the New Orleans dinner was right before the start of Mardi Gras and all that. So this one made sense, too. And then the more we dug, the more we found there's so much there. So we'll never do something where it's a quick little, you know, blurb and then, you know, that's it. There's got to be a really neat story. Otherwise, it's not going to sell. I mean, everything's got to sell, right? So the more we dug, the more we realized how much he had, you know, really contributed to the viniculture of the country. And as a horticulturalist, he was groundbreaking. And the evidence is still there at Monticello, his original home. So, yeah, there's a story there. And he built fish ponds to feed his slaves and his own family. And, you know, we don't brush over things. We're very honest about the racial backgrounds of things and the cultural origins of things and the immigrant things. So, you know, when the 1620s Pilgrim Dinner was interesting because I had to say Indian all the time, and you're supposed to say Native American, but it's like, you know, I'm telling you a story about back then. So we use the word Indian, and we also, at the end of these dinners, we always do a toast. And so we always toast to the cultural component of the diversity of the dinners. It's really, they're always a great story. They're always a good story.
On the way over here this morning, I was thinking about this story about Thomas Jefferson. It was kind of like a wind legend, but at the time, it was probably, I would say, like mid-90s. But at the time, it was the most expensive bottle of wine ever sold, and it was for a charity auction. And so the famous story is the guy that bought it for like $400,000, but then the sommelier that was bringing the guy decided to serve it at the dinner. And it was like $400,000. So the famous story was the sommelier on the way over tripped and broke the bottle and the neck came off. But it was actually like I think 1780 bottle of Chateau Margaux.
Previously owned by Thomas
Jefferson. Yeah, because he actually, I guess with all of his wines, he would like take like some sort of like lacquer or something and put like TJ on it. So I always thought that was a funny story.
Yeah, that is a good story. I mean, he was very thorough, so I wouldn't be surprised about marking every single bottle.
Yeah, and he's also, the whole wine culture that he brought over here, I guess, was pretty important. Did he grow his own grapes, Dina?
He did. He just started, you know, we did a ton of research on this, and he had just gotten into trying to, he was a horticulturist too, so he wasn't looking for one monoculture where he could, you know, what grew the best and then make money on it. He wanted to explore every single variety of every tomato, every pea, every grape and everything, and then just study how it grew and what specific environment it wanted to proliferate. So he never had rows and rows and rows of something. He had a row of all the different peas, and then a row of all the different grapes and whatnot. So
and olives too. He brought over like how many hundreds of olives?
Trees? He brought 50,000 olive trees over, and then gave them to friends and asked them to plant them and then get back to them on how they grew and how they, in the attempt to try and find where they would grow the best. That specific project never connected to the olive oil culture per se, but it did translate through generations to people that wanted to grow olive oil, olives and olive oil in this country.
So. Where was all this taking place, by the way?
Well, in Virginia, you know, in Monticello. There are two sides to Thomas Jefferson. There's the president and the minister of France and his political roles. And then there's this guy who was a farmer at heart and who just loved to grow things. And that was Monticello. So the dinner is going to focus on both facets of TJ. We call it the TJ dinner.
I mean, sure. You guys are so familiar with him now. It's just like, how could you not?
We're like my pals. So we'll focus on the consummate host that he was at the president's house that was newly fabricated on the Potomac River. Because, I mean, remember, this is during, before, during, after the American Revolution. So there was a lot going on. He was a consummate host at the president's house. Spent a lot of his own salary on hosting dinners and importing wines and showing people a good time.
Do you think he was a decadent man?
Personally, no.
No.
When he hosted at the president's house, yes. Mm-hmm. He brought over the finest wines from France and Italy that he could find. It's not like Fresh Direct where they're showing up the next day. He places an order and 6 to 8 weeks later it shows up, you know. But anyway, so there was that side where it was very high end and it was very extravagant. But then at Monticello, it was actually quite simple. He was very heavy on vegetables, light on protein. He didn't eat a whole lot of protein, but he did like his game. He liked, you know, a good cut of beef, and he loved lamb and game hen. So
I was telling Katie also, too, I was thinking about I've been thinking about doing this forever, too. And it's funny that you're doing the Thomas Jefferson, but I always thought about doing a meal honoring Benjamin Franklin, oddly enough, because supposedly he was a vegetarian for a good portion of his life. So I thought it was, I guess when he was 16, he decided that killing animals was wrong. And then also, too, that if you ate vegetarian diet, that you could actually save money. So he would eat vegetables to save money to buy books. I always thought it'd be kind of cool to do like a vegan inspired, like what if, you know, I guess it's kind of, you know, because like, you know, vegans say that Benjamin Franklin and Leonardo da Vinci and all these people, they were not vegan, but I always thought it'd be interesting to like see, you know, what kind of vegan dishes you could come up with using the ingredients that Benjamin Franklin had.
Well, that's very much the premise behind a lot of these dinners. You know, what can we come up with that's approachable and saleable and interesting that reflects on these stories? They don't have to be, you know, truly authentic. When I did when we did the pilgrim dinner, you know, it was, if I had done cornbread in the way that they ate cornbread, it's completely inedible by even 18th century standards. So I couldn't just give you a brick of dry sawdust. I had to at least make it palatable. So interpreting that is a lot of the fun, you know.
Yeah.
Have you had any ideas for a heritage series that just didn't pan out because?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we did, and we actually worked on it. But there was this neat story about Chipino in San Francisco in the 1920s, where this group of Italian fishermen immigrated from Genoa in particular, and then they sort of took over the fishing industries in the San Francisco Bay. Started making fish stew on the boats and with whatever the bycatch was from the day and some leftover shells and mussels or clams or whatever and some always Dungeness crab. And so this story of Chipino surfaced, and actually it was Katie's idea, and we looked into it and I just told you pretty much the entire story. So, you know.
And the menu.
There's the menu. A hunk of sourdough. Have a nice day. Yeah. So once the heritage dinners became large presentations and several courses and stuff, there wasn't enough for that story to fill out an entire heritage dinner. So
I can't believe how well researched all these ideas and concepts seem to be. I got to imagine that you're going out to a bar in the middle of researching TJ and just like all you can talk about with your friends is Thomas Jefferson and history and Scuppernong grapes.
My wife will tell you that I get a little detached for a little while we're trying to sort of nail down the story and nail down the menu. But it's fun. And
all the TJ books are all piled up at 10.
There's always a pile of books. I mean, there was the pilgrim dinner was interesting because there's not a lot of literature, obviously, generated from the 1620s it's not very well detailed. It's a grandson of somebody's who was so the connections are really loose and it was tough to dig. But since then there's just volumes of books on all these topics. So you know, actually not spending $300 on new books is is the challenge.
I was hoping when you came in that you were actually like trying to get into character and explore the mind of Thomas Jefferson and come like dressed head to toe as Thomas Jefferson with the powdered wig.
Yeah. Well, we did get dressed up for the Prohibition dinner.
We did, yeah. And the Prohibition dinner was also well documented, but we actually converted Chapter 1 into a speakeasy and blacked out the windows and had a three-piece band on the DL.
Wow.
But that didn't come from me.
I heard people were dancing.
I know. That's blasphemous.
All right. Well, we're going to jump to break, and then we'll be back with Professor Chefs Warren and Katie.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio is like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
All right, we're back. We got Chef Warren Baird and Chef Katie O'Donnell in the studio from Chapter 1 talking about their Heritage Series dinner. And want to talk a little bit more with Katie about, choosing drinks and, you know, for the night and wine and cocktails and more about the process of how how that's decided.
The first dinner I wasn't even on board for, so I missed that one. But the one in November, we did cider, so that was kind of simple. Sometimes the time period dictates pretty strongly what the beverage is going to be. For the Prohibition dinner, I came up with a cocktail menu of Prohibition-era cocktails, but then the cocktail that we served complimentary, we served rum punch in coffee cups to everybody because that was kind of what they did at the time. So that was kind of cool. And so for Thomas Jefferson, it's been really interesting because sourcing the wines has become quite challenging. At first, I wanted to see if I could find a winery that he actually procured wine from. And
I heard the 1780 Margot we mentioned earlier was excellent.
Exactly. So
we find one, we'll call you.
We can't really afford Chateauneuf du Pape, but we can dream about it. But we did get some Scuppernong, which we were pretty excited about.
What is it? I read about that. What is it exactly?
It's a muscadine wine, so it's actually grown along the coast of the Carolinas in Virginia.
Oh, wow.
It's a sweet dessert wine, essentially.
Not really on the par of like Sauternes, per se. But it gets the job done.
Well, now the muscadine grapes, is that something that maybe Thomas Jefferson brought over or no?
No, they were
already indigenous.
They were indigenous. He actually did. There was a letter that he wrote, I think it was, that he was saying like that he was amazed that there was actually this wine being produced in in America, and Virginia had the first winery in America. Actually, it wasn't California.
Wow. Yeah.
So you're a chef. You're doing general. You're the general manager at Chapter One, but your background is a chef. Did you have all of the wine knowledge and experience before coming into this? Because you seem very knowledgeable about drinks and pairing with Chef Warren's.
Well, when I was at ESCA, I used to train on the floor with the Somme because I wanted to learn more about Italian wine. And even just as, being the chef de cuisine, you're responsible for running the restaurant when the owner is and the chef, executive chef's not there. So the best way to figure out how to do that is to spend time in front of the house. So that's when I really started to geek out on wine. And by nature, I love beer. So the craft beer, scene is blowing up has been a lot of fun. But when I came on board to Chapter One, there was no beverage program. It was just like, this is a restaurant that has a bar, and the bar has beer and cocktails that don't reflect the food or Warren's vision in any way. So the first thing I did was get rid of all the imported beers and put all American craft beers on tab, simplified the cocktail menu. We try to make some of our own infusions and stuff, but, so that it's seasonal and local and we're always collaborating on things. So
it's very helpful for me to have somebody like Katie as the GM because she knows where I'm coming from food wise. So, so our collaborations I get more from a GM than I've ever even imagined, and support for me on my day off and stuff like that. Things that you wouldn't think about, the intangibles. So, it's really been a blessing to have her on board.
Sometimes, like a couple weeks ago, I was like, rhubarb, can we get rhubarb yet? And he was like, all right, I'll look into it. I was like, come on, it's spring. Let's do this.
I'm in the middle of doing a sandwich shop out in Bushwick, but we're taking the beer pretty seriously. But I saw that you guys are using the,
Bell's Too Hearted?
Yeah, the Bell's Too Hearted. I love that stuff so much.
Oh, yeah. Well, we have Hop Slam on right now.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I love Hop Slam.
Love that beer.
Yeah.
And when we bought it and we actually had it. We had too many other beers in the lineup because we were doing the craft beer week, so we had to wait. But then I was gone for a couple of days a week or two ago, and I was like, if this kicks, I forgot what we had on the line. And I was like, don't put the Hop Slam on until I get back. He was like,
it was
okay.
Like, we had it for like how many weeks just sitting there staring at
five,
us, talking
six
junk?
Weeks? Yeah.
Mean Old Tom, anyone? Have you had Mean Old Tom?
No.
It's
is that a reference to Thomas Jefferson?
No. Yeah, Mean Old Tom. That'd be a good thing to have. It's from Maine Beer Company. It's one of the best beers I've ever had.
Maine Beer Company is good.
It is, I think, $250 for a six-till, though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We actually, me and my business partner, we're like trying to figure out, like, we're only doing 10-ounce pours of it. And then, I priced it out, and I was like, it would be $1,300 for one keg.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I'm going to tell you.
Even a 10-ounce pour is generous.
Yeah, it's so special, though. Yeah.
Mean Old Tom.
Yeah, it's chocolate coffee, like, stout yumminess. Yeah.
I'm
fantastic.
On it.
Mm-hmm.
That's at High Hello now?
High Hello. Well, we're not officially open yet, but it will be. Yeah.
No, you guys are officially open.
No, well, Thursday.
This is Sunday.
Oh, yes, this is Sunday. We've actually been open for 4 days. Happy Easter, by the way. Yay.
Happy Easter, everyone.
That's right.
What are your hours? Are you open for lunch or just dinner or brunch or anything like that?
Dinner 7 days and then brunch Saturday, Sundays at the moment.
Yeah. What's your brunch menu looking like? What are you...
Brunch, I have a lot of fun with brunch, trying to do as much in-house as I can, in-house sausage, in-house bacon, in-house cold smoked salmon, and then duck hash, takes on some classics.
Yeah.
A lot of the food, both dinner and brunch, the ideas behind it is just take an American classic that's, so old and tired and a little dated and give it a fresh facelift. So.
Nice.
The brunch is actually quite amazing. He's being very modest.
Oh, yeah?
Especially the duck hash.
I like duck hash. It stays on all year round.
Nice.
The vegetables that go in change. That's
I like duck anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a duck-centric menu for sure. But we also take care in where we source things, and we use a lot of regional stuff. But I also... So another challenge at Chapter 1 is say, all right, well, there's a lot of this hyper-regional approach to food, which is great, but, it's like saying in France you can only go 25 miles outside of Paris, where in France they don't look down on you for using something down on the southern coast of France. You get to use all of France. We have, in the United States, we have more of as strong of a climatic range as any country, so... Between California and Florida and the Northeast, we have everything. So yeah. I have no qualms about using something from California or something from Florida because it's still American. And so I'm actually weeding out anything that's imported. So the oils come from California and no more Italian, no more prosciutto. We have amazing hams that come out of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So we are all American as much as we can get. Now, I had... On a sad note,
white asparagus.
Yeah, white asparagus.
I can see, look at his face. He's like,
I just love white asparagus. I just have always loved it throughout my career, and I just been talking to purveyors, and it turns out there really is very little, if any, white domestic asparagus. So it's all imported. So
can you just talk to an asparagus farmer and have him cover in sand?
We're gonna work on that. That'll be now for next year. In the meantime, I have to let go of white asparagus, and it's very sad.
It's tragic.
Yeah.
It's really brutal.
They had it all lined up for the new chicken dish for the spring, and it's like, oh, never mind. No one makes it here. So.
until you can get a good relationship with a farmer going,
you know?
Yeah. It's something, this is a topic we've talked about on the show a few times, is just the idea of hyperlocalism versus regionalism. In California, you can do that hyperlocalism. It's all available to you. In the Northeast, it's just not, but regionally, you can get a lot of things, a lot of different produce. But ultimately, if you want to serve the best, you have to go to where, as Patrick would say, terroir, the mind and the culture for raising these things are, and source the best.
Yeah, and it's also about, what type of farmer you support, not necessarily exactly where they are. Are you supporting commodity farmers, or are you supporting local guys that are really taking care of the soil and where, how they raise and their impact on the environment? So... if I can support a good farmer in California or a good farmer in Florida, I'm on board. These guys are American and they're doing the right thing. So, obviously, we don't ever need to get corn that's not from the Northeast because there's plenty of it. So, I'm not going to get corn from California in April, if it's even there. But, it's the consciousness also expands beyond regionally and expands on what these guys are doing and how they're doing it, and if we can support that, then we're also supporting the right idea, so
supporting American farmers and American history.
Yay.
All in one sitting.
I did have one question. Do you think Thomas Jefferson was cooking? Do you know in your research, was he just telling his cooks, make me these peas?
Yeah, he didn't spend much time in the kitchen. His wife Martha died very young, but she still, even they had their slave, their right hand man or woman, most of the time it was a woman, in the kitchen, and they actually controlled the guard in the kitchen.
And his chef at the White House was French, right?
Yeah, and he sought after the strongest French chef he could find to install into the French the president's house. So.
Did you find any influences? I mean, just going back to the slave issue and Thomas Jefferson, did you find any influences from, you know, the culture that was brought, you know, through the slave?
It's an excellent question. This story in particular pales in comparison to what the 19th century New Orleans dinner uncovered.
Yeah.
Because there was an unbelievable melting pot of cultural influences in New Orleans in the 1800s. And the slaves that came from Haiti were different from the slaves that came from West Africa. And then you had the migrants that came down the Mississippi, the Acadians, that arrived very poor and established in the Bayou country. So that story was remarkable. I was overwhelmed with trying to piece together where things came from. And ultimately the best example of that is Creole cooking. You had the wealthy whites that employed the poor blacks, and what came out of Creole cuisine is a really healthy mixture of the two.
Yeah,
okra.
I wish we could have connected on this earlier. We just got I work for Heritage Foods, and we just brought in a bunch of lamb for spring. And we brought in Tunis lamb, which is actually one of Thomas Jefferson's favorite lamb breeds. Yeah. And it's, you know,
what's
a hard
it called?
Thing.
Tuna lamb?
Tunis.
Tunis. Yeah.
And originally from Tunisia. And it's an interesting conversation. It's like, well, you know, they were imported from Tunisia, and the founding fathers were really, you know, excited about them. But how they got here is aboard slave ships.
It's just like a
darker history and just import, you know, as far as the imports go and migration of peoples, their culture, and the livestock
and
they brought
along. A lot of it was forced, you know, so the best we can do now, because that happened a long time ago, is just to celebrate the what came out of that.
Yeah.
Do it some justice. So.
And acknowledge and not ignore, which it sounds like you guys are definitely being forthcoming.
Yeah, it's important to know your history and your roots and learn from them. You know, I think that applies to everybody in the kitchen or whatever else you do. It applies to everybody. So.
Well, it's exciting. For anyone listening, if you're interested in trying it out, the Thomas Jefferson dinner is going to be April 12th at Chapter 1. They can find more information. You know, Google is
on
a
website,
great resource.
And it's at 33 Greenwich Avenue.
Yeah. The website, chapter1.nyc, and it's all there.
Great. So anyone that's interested, stop in. Thank you guys so much, Warren and Katie. It was really great having you on today.
Likewise.
Happy Easter to everyone tuning in.
Happy Easter.
Yeah.
We going to go do an Easter egg hunt?
Yeah. The weather's good for today.
So. Yeah, nice and sunny.
Guys.
Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday.
Thanks. Bye.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.